to the show. I'd just be glad y'all didn't have to listen to, to the pre-conversation that we were just having there. But anyway, part two with Doug Peterson. Doug, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. What's it's, the weather like up there? We're still getting 100% heat index going on.
Yeah, it's a bit drizzly here in Vancouver. We started this about a few days ago, and I think we've got about 9 more months of this. So,
oh, wow. All right.
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, you don't have to shovel it, so I don't mind it too much. You know, you just put your rain gear on and get out there.
Well, let me ask you this. When I lived in places that had similar climates, I really started, because in New Orleans, it's sunny all the time, right? So it'll be shorts weather. I remember playing basketball, not well, but playing basketball in shorts during Christmas sometimes, you know? So sometimes the sun can be out for, you know, a very long time. When I was living in climates that was the opposite of that, or even just visiting for like a week, I really started having that seasonal affective disorder. Does that affect you at all when you have long periods of just dreariness?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, you have to endure, and you know, we have doctors recommending vitamin D, and a lot of people try to get away. You know, they go to places like Arizona and California just to get those sun rays. You know, but it does get on you after a while, and. And when spring comes around, you're sure glad.
Have you tried those true white lights? That seemed to help me a little bit.
I have not personally, no. I know someone who does that, and they have seasonal affect disorder. Probably should be something that I should look into.
It really surprised me as to how yellow the bulbs I had in my house were before I put the true white ones. It was really kind of, whoa, everything was, but then you have to paint the walls again. Cause you're like, wow, everything's kind of dingy now. but anyway, enough of the seasonal affective, disorder. And we get
positive now.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about spiritual abuse. Yay. a little more, a little more positive there. I had a couple of comments from our last conversation. Somebody was, saying it was interesting how specific we were getting and how particular we were getting with the word manipulation, you know. And so I looked it up I think the first definition wasn't necessarily anything negative. It was like, you know, a potter manipulates the clay, you know, that sort of thing. And we were using it in a negative fashion. So
right.
I thought that was a bit interesting. And let me ask you this, and we didn't, really talk about anything we were going to talk about before, but this is this kind of plays into it a bit. So I don't know if you follow what's going on in China right now, right? So China has, I think it's called the three-stage church, and that's kind of the only official church. These house churches won't be monitored by the government. And of course, all these house churches are getting in all sorts of trouble. But I believe one of the rules is you really can't try to tell your kids anything about religion until they're 18. And growing up the way I did, I was like, man, that might be a good idea. So the spiritual manipulation can come at a very early age. But now we're also dealing with the idea of what role do parents have, especially if parents are really committed to a certain belief system, to teach their kids when primarily it is just indoctrination? And I've seen a lot of people like that in some of these home church / homeschool, very isolated environments, kids that really don't know how to think. And they don't know. Now, not all like that. I know some homeschool kids that are brilliant, right? And they've really excelled in all sorts of intellectual, feats. But I do know some, and I have seen some, that their parents taught them one way of living, one way of believing, and they're very socially awkward and intellectually stunted because of that. And I feel like on some level, that's abusive. And like I said, growing up the way I did, only learning one belief system and taught that everything else was, demonic or whatever, and growing up in one of those end time cults almost, That's what you believe. So I got to wonder where do you draw the line between a parent's right to teach their kids versus their right to indoctrinate them in some form of, well, at least I would consider it unhealthy religious mindset and practices.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a really good observation. I mean, I was brought up, you know, very indoctrinated, and it took me decades to unlearn a lot of the stuff that I just held so tightly to. And I'm probably a lot of people that grew up Christian have experienced that. On the other hand, you got people who grew up in households that were not religious, and they somehow, you, as a young adult, you go towards religion, and you end up religious anyway. So, you know, I don't know there's any pattern that works. I lived with a family, a pastor and his wife, and they had three kids. And the son ended up, in a great, great household. But the son ended up, joined the military, was suicidal afterwards, and became an alcoholic, it had nothing to do with the upbringing, I think sometimes, your mind gravitates towards, something you've been taught, or maybe it rejects it, I don't have a clue as to, what's right. It depends on the person, really. I can say that for my daughter, I don't think that I've been very heavy-handed in terms of, trying to help her reach a certain conclusion. I don't think she's religious at this point. I don't think that she's got a religious bone in her. Some people would say, well, Doug, you're not doing your job, she's got friends who are Christian. She's got friends who are Buddhist. She's got friends who are, all different religions and agnostic. Those are her big influences right now. And, I'm just happy she's got really healthy friends. And so I think that's going to be the biggest thing in your life when you're a teenager is your social circle. And I don't know any amount of religious indoctrination is going to help you in that aspect. What do you think?
Well, I guess I did tours down here for a really long time, and I went on a tour with somebody that we were going to hire, and we were talking about the Spanish Inquisition in New Orleans, which it did happen, but it's mm-hmm. New Orleans. Nobody really enforces any law down here, but it was in place for a while. And this other guy, Mark, tour guide, great tour guide, he said something that just kind of blew me away. He said, we look back on this from our perspective now, from a secular society or whatever, but imagine if you really believed you were saving someone's soul from eternal mm-hmm. conscious torment. And, these ideas of that, which I grew up with, and I think Chris Date from Rethinking Hell said it best. It was the worst thing you could possibly think of while you're being gang raped, that's what hell mm-hmm. is. It's just this horrible, horrible thing. And I was kind of almost taught that it was like a partnership between God and the devil, right? Like God hands you over to the devil, and then he gets to, do all kinds of things to you. So there was this weird kind of partnership going on with them. But if you truly believe that during the Inquisition, and I truly believe that, mm-hmm. Doug, you were going to have this fate worse than anything, then it would make sense on right. some level for me to torture you, yeah. burn you, do something. So that being said, growing up in the religious tradition I grew up in, their idea of hell was that plus, 10 times that or whatever. So they were very forceful in their indoctrination of belief. You got to believe, whatever, because in their weird, bizarre way of thinking, the church, my parents, whatever, didn't want us to grow up, die, and have to experience that.
Right.
So it's a twisted logic yeah. that's going on. So I think their answer to you would be, or their question to you would be, well, why don't you love your child enough to make sure that she doesn't experience that form of eternal conscious punishment. Now, they're also assuming that you believe in eternal conscious punishment. And the guilt that they would put on you is, well, Doug, what if she dies now in a car accident? You know, whatever. That's what they always put up. That was always the pressure for the altar call, the pressure for the decision.
Definitely.
What if you died right now? And it gives you no time to think about anything. And it's really, at least for me, was motivated by fear. So, well, I better just make this decision despite what I really believe or despite what my motivations mm-hmm. are, because I don't want to end up in this situation. So there's no room to think. There's no room to grow. There's no room to try to figure out things on your own. It's black and white, and you got to figure it out right now. So I guess that would be the pushback, the inquisition that I grew up in, and the inquisition that I feel is in a lot of the conservative churches, is there for a reason, not just because they're mean, but it's there because they believe that the punishment, if you don't believe, is so dreadful that they'll do anything they can, including, there's a video that was viral about a youth pastor or a pastor punching a kid. Did you ever see that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, he punches the kid and he says, "You better get right with God." And that was the motivating factor for this kid to get right with God.
Oh.
And I feel like that was the same kind of thing that we experienced. You know, I got put in a headlock once by a youth pastor because I wasn't believing the BS that he was dishing out or whatever. But they're not above that, right? They're not above, at least I've experienced some of those sorts of things, because what they believe is so. You're going to experience something so horrible that they're going to do anything they can to make sure that you don't do that.
Yeah, I even came across this church in Oregon, I was with the mission team at the time, and we were visiting this church. We were staying in a basement or someplace, and one of the pastors, they had two pastors. One was this sort of compassionate father figure pastor, and the other was a real fiery evangelist pastor, and the church seemed to be sort of almost split between the two pastors. Some people like this guy, and some people like this other guy. And I think the church actually did a split because they just couldn't reconcile having two different, completely different personalities for pastors. But the one pastor who was a fiery evangelist, he actually bragged about the fact that he had visited this guy in a hospital. And the guy wasn't a believer. And here's a guy suffering in the hospital in a lot of pain. He takes the guy's hand, grips it as hard as he can, and says, "Okay, you're going to say the sinner's prayer with me now." And he just starts squeezing. And the guy was just in screaming out in pain, and did it out of the fact that he wanted the guy to let go of his hand. And of course, the feather in his hat is that, now the guy is in the kingdom of God because he did this heroic act of, it's better that I gripped his hand and put him in pain than for him to suffer eternity in hellfire. You know, and I just think that reasoning is just whack, and I don't know. I mean, I think really, if you really want to believe in a literal place of torment, and that's your impetus for, making people converts. I mean, the kind of the things that you have to bring yourself to doing. And I did this as a young adult. I went to malls and I handed out tracts to people, and I really believed that everybody I handed a tract to was going to have an opportunity to escape hellfire. And it was just like there's a lot of, guilt and a lot of pressure to have to perform when you have that mindset. So, I think people really have to ask themselves, are there healthier alternatives to a theology than that,
Well, I know listening to, and I already mentioned this before, but the Rethinking Hell podcast, one of the interesting statements you get from people who accept the traditional view, and we're not passing any judgments on any of this right now, I'm just saying what this, I find this conversation fascinating. One of the pushbacks that you get from conservative evangelists, if you will, is, well, then what's my selling point? And it's like, well, hold on. Is that what this is all about? What's the selling point, or what actually the truth is? So that's kind of interesting, but that seemed to be a common complaint of, well, if hell doesn't exist, then I don't need Jesus. And it's like, wait a second, that's not, are you saved because you don't want to go to hell? Are you saved because Jesus loved you and wants to be in a relationship with you? And I found that very startling, that a lot of people were very upset that people were even challenging hell. You know, Francis Chan has a book about, you know, everybody's talking about it now, but the pushback being that it's, there's, you know, you lose the selling point, and why would you want to become a Christian? That's insane, right? You want to become a Christian because the creator of the universe humbled himself, came down here, and became a servant for us and an example for us. Like, that's the motivating factor, because God so loved the world, right? That's the motivating factor to become a Christian, or it should be, biblically speaking, not so you don't have to go to hell. And that really, at least I think it showed the true colors of some of these guys. But that was kind of like, wow, that's your whole salvation is based on, like, what would you do then if you were in, what if God was a jerk? But would still send you to hell? Or, you know, would you still follow him if he told you to murder babies just so you wouldn't go to, you know, I mean, how far do you want to take that logic of following a God just because you don't want to be punished? You know, if that's your motivating factor, I found it quite alarming and disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I have a couple cool quotes from former Altar Boys, Rick Alba, that were off Facebook. And I'm wondering if I could share those with you.
Oh, yeah, great.
On the podcast. As you know, Rick Alba, he was one time in the band The Altar Boys, which were back in the 80s and 90s even. They were kind of the... they were sort of doing punk-oriented music with a heavy evangelistic edge, and quite good at it, too. And they're still going around, actually. Rick, he's definitely rethought a lot of this through, and he came out of the closet, I guess, about a decade ago or so, and every now and then he gets on Facebook and, you know, talks about, you know, the changes and such. But one thing he's talking here, and I asked permission just last night if I could use this, and he said, go for it. So anyway, the Altar Boys, they had an album called When You're a Rebel. So just to put this in context, it was a good-selling album. The relationship between when you're a rebel and Romans 12:2 was to conform to Scripture rather than to the world. A question facing the Christian youth music scene in those days was, what shall we do with punk rock? After a generation of Christian hippies dressed in flowers, sitting in circles with acoustic guitars, the punk rock motif was very military resistance. And he gives examples, the Clash, the Alarm. Okay, then. So what would a Christian youth be militaristically resistant of? Easy back pocket answer, sin. Thus was given birth to the anti-world militancy in Christian youth circles. It was benign enough when we were doing it in 1984. It was really just a lyrical style and a look. But it got hijacked into an extreme anti-intellectual religious fundamentalism that today has grown into a national attitude that wins elections and impacts all our lives. And that's his quote. And so there's a lot behind that. Yeah. I'm not going to get I'm not going to get political here. I think there's definitely podcasts dedicated to the current political system that are far more informative than anything I can hand out here. And I think, you know, if you are a Trump supporter to this day, I don't think you or I can say anything that's going to change that for anybody. And if you're critical of what's going on in the U.S. right now in political terms, then I'm going to be preaching to the choir anyway. So I don't really want to get into the politics of it, but I do think there is something behind what Rick Alba is saying here, that, yeah, we had to have a common enemy, and so it became sin, or it became the devil, or, you know, what have you. And it's something that we can, it's an easy rah-rah to rally against, because it's something we all agree with, you know, let's eradicate the bad in our lives, and let's win this world for Jesus. So that was sort of the Christian rock motif at the time. And, you know, it's still quite popular. But there's also this thing that kind of comes with it that I think, you know, definitely needs to be some awareness to, is that, we trade the militancy of, you know, we'll do it our way, thank you very much, you know, the Ramones, you know, the Clash. And we trade in for sort of this anti-intellectualism, which says, well, you know, okay, yeah, the world is going to burn anyway. So let's just, you know, use up every fossil fuel we can, because, you know, Jesus is going to come back and we're not going to have to worry about this. It's going to be a mess. And, but that's, you know, that's the world we live in, you know, the world's evil. So I don't know how many people actually think that way, but there's probably a number of people that don't really think that the world is going to last another 1,000 years because Jesus is going to come back before then.
Yeah.
So why, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I kind of grew up in that whole idea, and, you know, I work at a Christian radio station, so there's a number of, whatever that means, that's a whole nother, you know, thing. Somebody called the other day and said, is this a Christian radio station? I'm like, well, we broadcast religious, I mean, I don't know what that means, but how an entity, you know, a Christian business, or how does that even work? But so many pastors that teach on this station, well, Jesus is definitely going to come back, you know, within the next, you know, 10 years or whatever. In the denomination I grew up in, the background I grew up, there was a disdain for the flesh, and I think it was interpreted inappropriately. So there was a non-caring for the body, right? So you could eat whatever you wanted to. Nobody ever talked about that. None of this really mattered. It was kind of this Platonic idea, right? That the things down here, including the earth we live in, are worthless. They're garbage. It's only what we have to look forward to. And I think that's part of the issue, too, is what we think about and what we believe when we read the Bible, right? We all have these preconceived ideas. Of course, we do too. Somebody might listen to this in 50 years and go, oh my God, those guys had such crazy, you know, preconceived notions about what they were, you know, what they were talking about. But I think that's part of the problem is you have to kind of, you know, people, it's the same group of people that says you just need to read the Bible plainly. And it's like, well, you're not reading it plainly. Yeah. You're reading it with your own preconceived ideas, but you're biased enough to think that your own preconceived ideas are objective, which none of our preconceived ideas are objective. And I believe we read that Platonic idea into the text. I'll give you an example, right? So again, I don't know why I keep talking just in the conversation about hell, but the argument, and again, I'm not, that's not where I want to go with this conversation, but the argument against eternal conscious torment is the scriptures like the wages of sin is death. What does death mean? Well, if you believe the Platonic idea that the soul is inherently immortal, the Greek idea that the soul is inherently immortal, then death cannot mean what death means, right? It means something different because you don't believe the soul can die. So if you're reading the Bible with the idea that the soul can never die and you come across a scripture like the wages of sin is death, then you believe, well, no, it can't be because I don't believe that the soul can die. So you're reading into the scripture something that's not there. I believe at least the ways I grew up in, there was such a disdain for the earth. There was such a disdain for the flesh that the only thing people had to look forward to was the return of Christ. And sadly enough, that meant all sorts of horrible things, like we're not going to take care of the earth and we're not going to take care of our bodies. Which was problematic. Yeah. And if anybody tried to, then you were told, you know, well, you know, you're just you're vain, or you know, you're putting your treasure, you know, in the wrong places, and now we see where your heart is, you know, that kind of shenanigans. So there is an idea there, and that's definitely not, at least what I get out of the Bible, and that's definitely a mindset that I had to change. I'm going off on a tangent now. I don't even remember what your original
but question was. It's a good tangent, because I mean, we're kind of you know, if we've been, you know, a lot of people have been raised in churches, and I mean, it's in the hymns, it's in the way we interpret scripture. I mean, there was a reason why, you know, when they were doing religious music in the 1800s, you know, there was still slavery happening then, and a lot of the music that they wrote, the slaves wrote, were escapist for a reason. They didn't see much hope in this world. You know, they were slaves. And so when they said, you know, I'll fly away into glory, glory land and all this, that was their hope, is that things would get better for them after they died. You know, and I think that same escapist mentality still pervades in the church, that, you know, there's something better beyond the clouds that we don't really know much about, but that, you know, that heaven is waiting us, and, you know, we have that to look forward to. And so, meanwhile, you know, like, there's a lot of problems down here, and, you know, and there always will be, and we just have to accept that, you know, God knows, God's in control, you know, and we throw out those cliches. And it's really, it can get very sloppy, you know, because, we're not doing a lot here to actually, you know, make some long-term change, because we don't really believe long-term change is going to change anything, you know, so we're not taught to think that way.
Yeah. That's,
I have another quote here, and I think, this is also from Nick Alba. I got this just last night. And he has this picture of what looks like clouds, this big gold fortress surrounded by a rainbow. And he says, most of us were not trained in our churches to yearn for government by the people, for the people. We were not taught in our Bible studies to yearn for the balancing of ruling powers, for checks and limits on authority, for universal equal rights and dignity, nor for the ongoing perfection of the democratic republic. We were trained in our churches, Bible studies, music festivals, and harvest crusades to yearn for the sudden arrival of a mighty king who will vanquish our enemies and build us a glittering city with streets of gold, bordered by a huge wall to keep out the infidels, where we shall live forever in glory, while those not proven loyal to the king shall suffer forever in a lake of fire. Another doozy there. So, and that is kind of, you know, there, you know, I realize this is a, there's definitely some heavy doses of, you know, some stuff is just, you know, if you take this theology to its limit, you know, there might be some people that actually believe that, you know, the reason why we're doing is because we got to protect ourselves, our children, our children's children from this, the world that, you know, is evidently evil. And rather than get involved in the world, we sort of, we come up with our own alternative. And that's sometimes harbored in the safety of people who think like us.
Well, let me throw this out there. There's a wonderful book called The Righteous Mind by a guy named Jonathan Haidt, who's not a Christian. And the last I heard, the interview I heard, he was an atheist. And he has a test that you can go take, and they use it for this further research. But he proposes the idea, and of course he has research to back this up. Doesn't necessarily mean it's true. I'm just quoting, you know, what he said in the book. But that conservative people have a higher rate of disgust towards things that they don't like than non-conservatives do. And I thought that was fascinating. You know, I'm a history buff, right? So, you know, I told you I did tours for a while, and I'm planning on doing some tours of Germany and, you know, places like that. So I'm really kind of brushing up on my Nazi history. And after I heard, I read the Jonathan Haidt book, and then I'm reading all these things, particularly by the you know, the Nazi thinker Rosenberg, which everybody of course made fun of him because that was his real last name, you know, a Jewish sounding name. But anyway, it was about the purity of the blood. It was this idea of disgust. And I didn't grow up, obviously, a neo-Nazi, but man, there are so many similarities between their ideas of purifying the land and purification and disgust towards the outsiders with what I grew up in, the religion I grew up in. It was kind of mind-boggling, but I think that's part of the reason, if any of this is true, why conservatives are the way they are. And again, we all have our preconceived ideas, but if your preconceived idea is disgust towards something that is not similar to you, then that's what's going to happen, is you're going to read the text with this idea that you will have these walls around you, and the outside, the infidels will be on the my goodness, who knows what that is. And if you look at communist history, communist history, you know, the majority of the people said, let's kill the rich 10%, and then they do. And then the remaining people say, let's kill the rich 10%, and then you keep going, right? And I feel like that's kind of how these holiness, separatist, fundamentalist churches are, is they keep doing that, man. They just keep chopping off the top 10% and until they're left with almost nobody, you know? I think the Gulag Archipelago says throughout the reign of communism, 60 million people were either dead or in gulags. Because of that continuing process that keeps going on and on. But that's how I was taught Christianity. And when you see a scripture that says something like, come out from among them, be separate, man, those were the scriptures that weighed so much more than these other scriptures about going into the world and preaching the gospel. It wasn't you become a follower of Christ as you are. It's become a follower of Christ like we want you to become a follower of Christ. And so that idea of disgust,
scriptures that you know, I mean, it's a, sort of a cloisterism. You know, you want to have a hedge of protection around you, so surround yourself with positive people who you know, read the Bible in a way that we've been taught. You know, and I think that's, you know, I think that's why there is that in place, is because once you start thinking outside that box, well, you know, who knows where that's going to lead you to, you know. So, you know, I remember growing up, I wasn't really encouraged to read books that were not Christian, you know, or you know, or look at magazines, or, you know, listen to secular music. There was just such a fear that, you know, if you do that, you know, you might end up thinking that way. And so I was never exposed to a lot of the, you know, the music and books that a lot of my friends were into. And so I didn't really have a lot of discussion on things that, other than, you know, the stuff that, you know, I thought were safe, you know. So, you know, I mean, my theology, you could pretty much fit into like a chick track or something, you know. It was very simplistic.
Well, because if it's based on you and that decision, you know, like I've been to a lot of decision-based churches, and they never grow beyond that, because they can't grow beyond the chick track. It's all about making the decision. And the problem with decision-based theology, and I know I harp on this a lot, is if you're making the decision out of fear, are you really making an honest decision? What if you check out, you know, the girl in the pew in front of you while you're making that decision, while you're reciting the sinner's prayer? Does that nullify it because you were lusting? What if your mind wandered to something else? What if you're, you know, you don't know. We don't know our own heart, right? So that's always been a struggle. Is how do you make that decision? So I've seen people in those decision-based churches that are constantly making a decision, and sometimes afterwards getting baptized again, because they say, oh, it was an authentic decision, or if I would really made that decision, then I wouldn't have sinned last week or whatever. And so it stays on that level of a chick track, and then you become obsessed with the idea of, did I make the right decision? And then people, well, you got to end the prayer in Jesus's name, or, and just for people who are listening maybe, and are not familiar with this, the sinner's prayer is not in the Bible. I asked a pastor once where it was.
No.
Where is that in the Bible? He says it's in the back. They printed it in there. Is it, or you know, whatever their denomination printed it in there in the back, but it's not in there. You know, it's take up your cross and follow me. There's something. There's this call that comes from God, right? And you respond to the call, but that's a tricky word too, right? So the idea of responding again, if it's up to you, and I don't want to get into Calvinism versus Arminianism, but you know, it's you're stuck there is on that point of, am I making this decision? And that's a loaded word, you know, as well. So you're always stuck on that level. And you're not able to move forward. There was a good analogy I read a couple of days ago about, man, I forgot who said this. I'm sure somebody's going to be, you know the name, because I think it's a famous philosopher who said this. But it was about an astronomer who had a big telescope out, and he's looking at the stars, and he sees everything except what he's looking for. And then somebody said, well, what are you looking for? And he said, I'm looking for the Earth. And it's like the eye, you know, the church is so focused on how the eye works that they're scared to even use it to look at anything. And that's kind of where it seems to be stuck. But again, if you have that fear of hell as eternal conscious torment, and you don't want your kids to go there, and you want to make sure they make that decision correctly, and then you got all these other issues, eternal security, or, you know, all that kind of stuff going along. You can't move past the starting point. You're obsessed with the starting point and what that is. And if that's the case, then who cares about the Earth? Who cares about eating right? None of that really matters. You know, what matters is who cares about feeding other people? Nothing. None of that matters, because the only thing that matters is your salvation and their salvation. And so, you know, I do some missionary work, and sometimes that argument comes up is, what's more important, to feed somebody or to share the gospel with them? And I know how I am when I'm hungry. I'm not listening to anything anybody's saying. But I think we learn that lesson from the Good Samaritan, right? We learn to do unto others, and we learn to put others first. And I think that there's nothing wrong with doing both of those at the same time. You know, the argument against God is that there's sin and evil in the earth. I think that 95% of the evil on the earth could be eliminated if we would just take responsibility, not just Christians, but everyone, and do what they're supposed to do. It doesn't take much to feed a kid in Africa, and every 6 seconds, a kid dies, you know? We could change that. Jimmy Carter got rid of that little bug that would crawl up, I forgot what it's called, that worm that would crawl up people's urine stream while they were peeing, and then eat them from the inside out in a very painful manner. He did that. We can eliminate these things. It's not necessarily God's fault. It's our fault. We're asking God, what are you doing? And God's asking us, well, what are you doing? You're destroying the earth, and you're not taking care of people. You're not treating people like I would treat them, because Christianity is stuck on start. We can't move past that, because we're so concerned that we get our theology right and we get that decision right, that we can't move past that. And because of that, you're just focused on that. And again, I wasn't born in anything close to the Inquisition, but there was a lot of pressure there on anything that would taint you, right? Any sort of worldly connection, because that, you know, that sense of purity and that sense of disgust was so strong. Anyway, there's a sermon I wasn't planning on preaching. Sorry about that.
You know, this thing of spiritual manipulation, I think the reason why it intrigues me so much and intrigues you as well, is I run into it all the time. I felt like I brushed up against it just a couple weeks ago. There are people in your lives, you know, who would like to be more assertive with, you know, well, brother, you know, if you just had the right beliefs, you know, you would be in right standing with God. Questioning your entire integrity, you know, based on the fact that you're not aligned with, you know, a certain way of thinking or a certain way of doing things. I started thinking, what are the things to look for spiritual abuse? Because I think the difference between spiritual deception and spiritual manipulation is spiritual deception is where, you know, you just have the wool pulled over your eyes and you can't see the forest for the trees in terms of somebody who's, you know, like faith healers, for example. There's Peter Popoff was found to have a wire that his wife would talk to him from prayer cards that came in, and she would say the person's name, their ailment, and then he would go to that person in the big auditorium and then, you know, lay hands and, you know, they're healed and, you know, but he was proved to be a fake. And a lot of people were deceived by that. The people who were manipulated were the people that actually went forward and thought they were healed. So there's that fine line between, like, yeah, there's a lot of deception, but to be actually manipulated, to actually participate with it, what are things to look for, you know? I came across this YouTube site. I don't know if I'm going to have time to go through all the points, but there are some interesting ones. Talks about, you know, for example, a leader in a Christian sect or a Christian church, they demand your respect, okay? And one of the ways they'll get at you is if you have a disagreement with them, they'll just come at you well, you're not being respectful, you know, and they kind of guilt you out of the fact that, you know, you're not showing respect when you don't listen to this. This is the clear truth here, and you're being rebellious, and there's all these little tactics. My brush up with feeling like I could have been manipulated in my life about 10 years ago. I lived in an intentional Christian community for about a year and a half, and it's taken like a decade just to find out, like, how did I get there? How did I get to that place where I allowed people to speak into my life the way that they did? You know, why was I that gullible? And how do I, there's like 10 different points of what to look for, and they all rang very true for me, every single one of them, you know, and I sure wish I'd come across that YouTube page earlier.
But I'll tell you what, can you send me the link and we'll put it in the show notes?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll definitely do that. I think the thing that saved me, apart from just, you know, being open to God and everything, was that I had a few friends that were not part of that Christian community that I could go to and talk to about these things. And I would go there to some of these friends, and not in the position of trying to gossip about it, but just rather sharing, like, am I processing this right? Like, you know, what would, you know, trying to get a second opinion about, you know, do you think this is cool, what's happening? And they would, you know, say from a position of not being in that community with, you know, like, no, man, that's just not, that's not typical at all. You know, like, they're asking you to do what? You know, but that's kind of what helped me through, you know, the stuff that I had to deal with. I had to, you know, get to a place where I was willing to just walk out and knowing that I didn't have to feel guilty about leaving a situation that wasn't healthy at the time. I imagine there's probably people who can relate to that, you know, being in a church or being in a community, and whether it's intentional or non-intentional, where they feel like, you know, there's just some things that a leader has said that are just, you know, man, they don't sit right with me. And I think it's helpful to know, you know, when there's manipulation happening. That's all I'll say about that.
Excellent. Well, we are out of time, and that was awesome conversation. Thanks again, and mm-hmm. I'll definitely...
Thank you.
Yeah, I definitely want to continue these conversations with you. So have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mike. You as well.